Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, May 30th, 2018, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, our conversation is on the White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative Executive Order. My name is Laura Flint, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Melissa Rogers, non-resident senior fellow of governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and Stanley Carlson Tease, founder and senior director of the Institutional Religious Freedom Alliance. After hearing from our speakers, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Stanley. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Laura, and thank you, Melissa, for being part of this as well. Our focus is the May 3rd executive order that President Trump signed, establishing a White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative. This comes on the background of other efforts in previous administrations, so we'll sketch some of that background and then talk about what's different about the Trump executive order and the principles he laid down in that. So I'm Stanley Carlson Tease. I'm glad to be joined by Melissa Rogers. She was executive director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships in the last number of years of the Obama administration. And I was on the staff of the George W. Bush White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives at the very start of his administration when that initiative was kicked off. So we kind of bookend those two administrations and their so-called faith-based initiatives. Between those times of service and before them, Melissa and I have often been engaged with others in initiatives to find or create common ground considering this particular big question, what are the legitimate freedoms and restrictions on religious organizations that accept federal government funds provide services to the public, adoption services or welfare services, overseas development, and so on. This question is even more important because a lot of federal spending goes to state and local governments and makes up a large part of what they spend on social services, healthcare, and so on. And so the federal rules go with the federal money down to state and local governments. So the rules set in this initiative or as part of this initiative affect a lot of the social spending that's done by governments at all levels. So what should those rules be? What does the Constitution require? What's fair for all the participants, government, different kinds of governments, religious organizations of varied faiths, secular organizations that are competing for funds, the people who need government-supported services? Starting back in the mid-1990s, Melissa and I have worked on with many others to promote policy, laws, and regulations that answer these questions within the constitutional boundaries and in a way that different points of view would recognize these as being constitutional. So I think while we will talk today particularly about President Trump's executive order and its background, which contains his revisions to the White House Faith Initiative and his revisions to the principles that should govern the federal partnerships with faith organizations. We're going to emphasize specific changes. We will also be addressing this larger question of the common ground that has supported and should support the rules for the federal engagement with faith-based organizations. So on this call, I'm going to set the stage, some of the background, makes it easier to see what's different, what's continuity with what President Trump has said in his executive order. Then Melissa will talk about how President Obama took up the precedents of the Bush years and what he did with that legacy, and then she'll address the changes that come with President Trump, and then I'll reflect a little bit further on President Trump's changes. And then we'll open up the discussion to you on the call. So starting out here with the background on the faith-based initiative, that shorthand that people use, we want to always remember that this is not just about faith organizations, faith-based organizations, but also about secular ones, particularly smaller ones that typically haven't been so closely engaged with government services and now are being asked to be more involved. So background on the faith-based initiative and then the actions of the Bush administration. It may be surprising to some of you on the call, but actually the basic principles and the idea of a federal faith-based initiative are now more than two decades old. The basic principles, the idea, go back at least to 1995 and 1996, when Congress was fundamentally revising federal welfare law. And in that redesign, many in Washington had decided that it was important that the federal rules attached to federal government money should be changed so that religious organizations that provide services to the poor could participate as part of the federal welfare spending, and that they would be able to offer services without a concern that they would have to set aside or suppress, diminish their faith character. And why is that a concern? Well, if they had to suppress their faith character, or if their faith character made them ineligible, then they couldn't be part of the service delivery system. But also, perhaps with a change in how they served, what they did would not be as effective, as trusted by people coming for help. So why a desire to change the rules? I just said something about that. I think there were two major reasons. One was a perception that the Supreme Court's interpretation of the rules that govern church-state relationships with federal funds had changed. You could say, I guess, that an older view was strict separation of church and state, and that federal money should not go to any organization that looked particularly religious. A newer view, sometimes called equal treatment or neutrality, that the federal government should look out and find the best providers of service and not exclude religious ones, although religious organizations that get direct federal funding, like grants and contracts, can't use that money to spend it on religion. But nevertheless, they should be eligible to provide other kinds of services. So on the one side was some new ideas about the proper limits and the constitutional framework for government funding of organizations, including religious ones. And then I think at the same time, this policy reason I alluded to for wanting to change the funding restrictions. And that policy reason was a growing sense, very visible in Washington, D.C. in the 1990s, that sometimes non-government organizations and faith-based organizations in particular could be better able to help people in need than secular programs and bureaucratic government programs. If you just consider the value, the valuableness of services that are offered by organizations that are local and trusted by those who are seeking help, as opposed to going to some other service provider that might be more professional, but unknown and not trusted in the same way by somebody who's in a crisis. So this idea that sometimes faith-based and other local organizations could be the really good providers of services, and maybe even the best providers of services, is actually reflected in a paragraph in President Trump's recent executive order. And I just want to quote a few sentences to give you a flavor of the kind of thinking that was there back in the 1990s and has been carried forth in the 20-some years since then. So here's the few sentences from President Trump's executive order of early May. Faith-based and community organizations, he says, have tremendous ability to serve individuals, families, and communities through means that are different from those of government and with a capacity that often exceeds that of government. These organizations lift people up, keep families strong, and solve problems at the local level. The executive branch wants faith-based and community organizations, to the fullest opportunity permitted by law, to compete on a level playing field for grants, contracts, programs, and other federal funding opportunities. The efforts of faith-based and community organizations are essential to revitalizing communities, and the federal government welcomes opportunities to partner with such organizations through innovative, measurable, and outcome-driven initiatives, end quote. So that's a similar idea that people had back in the mid-90s as they were thinking about welfare reform. And so with that idea that sometimes religious organizations could be the best providers, they ought to be invited in, and that the Constitution and Supreme Court interpretations no longer required that they be excluded or discouraged from applying for federal funding, with those ideas as background, in the mid-1990s, as part of welfare reform, Congress adopted some new funding rules, some changes to the funding rules called charitable choice. So this was part of federal welfare law that governed federal money for welfare, and that money typically went right to states, and then states allocated it to private providers or ran their own services. So, and with that money from the federal government came these new rules called charitable choice. So this was a set of provisions in the welfare law that did a number of things. So let me just say what those are, and this gives a background to where we are now with President Trump and some changes to these principles that he proposed. So these provisions, charitable choice, in the first place, prohibited government officials who are making awards of funding for the provision of services from being biased either for or against religious organizations applying for money. So the money ought to go to the best provider, religious or secular, without a bias one way or the other. Second, the rules required government decisions and regulations to respect, here's my language, to respect and not suppress the religious character of faith-based organizations that accept federal money to provide services. So ability to have a board that has religious people on it, for example, and a religious atmosphere of the organization and so on. That's all outlined in principles and laws and regulations. Charitable choice required religious organizations that accepted these federal dollars to provide services not to discriminate against people seeking services, either because of the religion that they professed or the lack of religion or that they just did not want to take part in religious activities. They still could come for services provided with federal funds by religious organizations. Charitable choice further prohibited religious organizations from spending their government grant money or contract money on religious activities and religious expression. You know, for example, typical example, buying Bibles or paying for worship, things like that. That was all illegal. Further, charitable choice did say, however, that religious organizations could offer prayer, worship, other religious activities, but that would have to be paid for with private funds, not federal funds, and would have to be offered voluntarily to people coming for services, and they couldn't be required to take part in such religious activities. Then in kind of a special funding stream, funding condition, because of the Supreme Court's views on indirect funding or vouchers, scholarships, money like that, that if that's the way money would come to an organization, then religion could be part of the service. And you think here where the essentially the money or the authorization to get services goes to the beneficiary, and that person can pick from a number of providers. And if that's the setup, and among the providers are secular ones, then the person could predict, could choose a religious provider that would offer, that would have religion woven into the services. That's a kind of special case of voucher or indirect funding. And then finally, as part of charitable choice, and a particular note given President Trump's executive order, just to be sure to protect all the rights of people coming for assistance in charitable choice, there was a provision that a beneficiary who goes to a faith-based provider for help, but then decides that he or she finds the atmosphere religiously unacceptable, could request a referral to an alternative provider that was acceptable to them religiously. And then the government agency that provided the funding had to find that suitable alternative provider for the person who just said, you know, this Salvation Army or this Jewish organization, I just don't feel comfortable there. Find me another place. So that was part of charitable choice as kind of a super protection for people coming for help. All right, so you see here protections for the religious organizations, for the beneficiaries, and then kind of a level playing field in which whatever the organization is, it should not, officials shouldn't be biased for or against it. That was all part of charitable choice, which became part of the 1996 welfare reform law, and then was added that same kind of language to three other laws that President Bill Clinton signed into effect during his administration. At the end of his administration in the presidential election of 2000, both candidates who were running, Republican-Democrat, Texas Governor George W. Bush and Vice President Al Gore, they both said charitable choice is a good idea, we should expand that to other programs and make it possible for religious organizations to take part in other services as well as in these specific ones where the laws had been passed during the Clinton years. Even before George Bush gave his big speech saying this should happen, Al Gore had given his big speech saying this is what ought to happen. So kind of a interesting consensus at that point. When Bush became president, took office in January 2001, one of the first things he did was to declare his administration's commitment to these principles of charitable choice and more involvement by faith organizations and federally funded services. And within a month of becoming president, he had created what he called a White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, part of the Executive Office of the President, and then also counterpart centers for faith-based and community initiatives in five major federal departments that do social service spending. That was HHS, Housing and Urban Development, Labor, Justice, and Education. So in these centers that are expending federal money to provide services, to make sure that faith organizations and smaller community groups have a fair chance at that funding. Later on, during the Bush years and Obama years, other centers have been opened up: Homeland Security, Commerce, Veterans Affairs, Department of Agriculture, USAID, Overseas Development for the, in the Small Business Administration, and an emphasis on faith-based involvement also at the Corporation for National and Community Services, so AmeriCorps and those kinds of programs. So a White House office and then these centers and these agencies. So what's the point of all of these? Well, in the first place, to make sure that federal funding is awarded according to these charitable choice principles, those kinds of principles. Secondly, to identify barriers in the way the federal government operates that make it difficult for faith-based organizations and smaller secular organizations to work with government, and recommend ways to get rid of those barriers. Third, to build connections between local faith-based and secular organizations and the governments so that the government can learn some of this bottom-up, different way that community organizations help their neighbors. And then also to help federal program officers develop innovative new programming that better incorporates these organizations and their style of doing things. And in that whole process, the White House faith-based office would work with the centers in these agencies that are designing programs and allocating money. As part of this work to revitalize social programs, President Bush, besides setting up these initial offices in the White House office, the centers in the White House office, he issued Executive Order 13279 in December 2002 that said when the federal government spends money for social services, it ought to follow those charitable choice-like principles. So Congress had passed charitable choice for a number of laws. President Bush said, let's take those principles, put them into the regulations that govern other federal spending, and through the normal regulatory process that was done over the next few years. These are often called equal treatment regulations, very similar to charitable choice, that were then adopted across federal agencies that do spending for social services. So by the end of the President Bush's administration, there were these White House office and centers in these various agencies and these equal treatment regulations, along with charitable choice laws and those regulations, that stated the freedoms and restrictions on faith-based organizations that get federal dollars, and that applied to federal money spent by the federal government or by state and local governments. All of this in an effort to kind of rejuvenate programs to make sure that faith organizations had an equal opportunity to compete, and then hopefully that the federal services would become more effective. So I'll leave it there at the end of the Bush administration and turn it over to Melissa Rogers.
Okay, great. Thanks, Stanley. Good afternoon to all of you, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me to be on the call. I'm really looking forward to our conversation in a few minutes. So let me take up where Stanley left off with the Obama administration. During the campaign, then Senator Obama made a speech saying that if he were elected, he would retain the White House office that President Bush had established while putting his own stamp on its activities. And indeed, a couple of weeks after he took office in 2009, President Obama issued an executive order establishing the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. and retaining these agencies, centers for faith-based and neighborhood partnerships that Stanley described. And all those offices immediately began working to establish partnerships to serve people in need, both financial partnerships and non-financial partnerships, and to serve people in need both at home and around the world. So the White House office, for example, worked closely with the president and other White House and administration staff, as well as faith-based and humanitarian groups on issues like stopping the spread of diseases like Ebola and Zika, attacking poverty and increasing economic opportunity, combating human trafficking and climate change, which, of course, climate change threatens, as you know, the most vulnerable first and foremost, and welcoming refugees, for example, who had been admitted to our country after undergoing an exacting vetting process. And I could say a great deal more about that work, but during this call, I'm going to focus instead on the church-state rules that apply to these partnerships that Stanley's already described, and how the Obama administration addressed these rules, and then say a bit about how President Trump changed that with his executive order earlier this month. When President Obama established the White House office in February 2009, he did not remove any of the substantive provisions that President Bush had put in place with his faith-based initiative, all the ones that Stanley just described. Instead, President Obama had a different idea about the best way to proceed on these issues, some of which were controversial. And President Obama's idea was to appoint what he called an advisory council on faith-based and neighborhood partnerships. This was established in the same executive order that he used to open the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. And the council included people who were representing religious organizations as well as those who were representing non-religious community or humanitarian organizations that served people in need. And quite intentionally, President Obama appointed a very diverse advisory council, including members with different political, ideological, religious, and theological leanings. He wanted to bring people together across some of these difficult issues and ask them to seek common ground and recommend ways that the administration could strengthen the partnerships that it forms with faith-based and community organizations. And actually, within there were working groups within the advisory council that captured even more diversity. For example, the specific working group that was tasked with examining church-state issues included Stanley, a former staff member of President Bush's White House, as well as the head of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and leaders falling somewhere in between, including me. So you can see there's a very diverse group brought together and asked to seek common ground. Well, it won't surprise you to hear that this group could not agree on some important church-state issues, but members were able to agree on others, including the notion that more could and should be done to protect the religious liberty of social service beneficiaries. And so what the council did was unanimously make a slate of recommendations to President Obama. And some of those recommendations related to direct federal aid, such as grants and contracts, that subsidizes social service programming. And I'll refer to one of those recommendations that Stanley mentioned as a call for imposing an alternative provider requirement. The alternative provider requirement says that if social service beneficiaries object to the religious character of a federally funded social service provider, they should be referred to an alternative service provider of comparable value and accessibility. Now, as Stanley mentioned, this requirement was already part of some longstanding statutes and accompanying regulatory language that apply to a few federal grant programs. What council members did was recommend that this alternative provider requirement be applied across federal grant programs so that it would benefit a much wider group of beneficiaries. So council members agreed on that and made that recommendation to President Obama. They also agreed on issues like the fact that beneficiaries should not be discriminated against due to their religious beliefs or lack thereof, that any privately funded religious activities have to be separated from activities funded by direct aid, that beneficiaries should not be required to participate in religious activities like worship or Bible study, or discriminated against for doing so, for refusing to do so. And additionally, the council recommended that beneficiaries should receive a written notice to ensure that they understood protections like these, because we realized that there really could be no guarantee that beneficiaries would understand that they were protected in these various ways under federal law. So in November 2010, President Obama embraced these recommendations by signing them into law via an executive order. This one was Executive Order 13559. And then after a public notice and comment process, 9 federal agencies issued final rules implementing this executive order, and that was a process I coordinated when I served at the White House. So under the rules, religious organizations that receive direct federal aid for domestic programs are required to make reasonable efforts to refer beneficiaries to alternative providers if the beneficiaries object to an organization's religious character. And such religious providers are also required to provide beneficiaries with written notice of this and other beneficiary protections, as well as given specific contact information that they can use to report any violation of the rules. So just let's consider a few examples to think about how these rules change things across the federal grant and contract landscape. And here I'm just giving you a few cases to flesh this out. Assume an Orthodox Jewish man was assigned to a federally funded employment training program that meets in a church. And assume also that due to his religious beliefs, he cannot enter a church and ask to be referred to an alternative service provider. Under these new rules that the Obama administration established, we could be confident that reasonable efforts would be made to find alternative providers in such a case for this man. Take a different case. Assume a Catholic woman who is a victim of human trafficking is served by a federal grantee that's an evangelical organization. Assume also that this woman would prefer not to attend the privately funded Bible study that the evangelical provider separately offers because the Bible study conflicts with some of her religious beliefs, but she's fearful that not going to this Bible study might jeopardize her access to governmental benefits. Under the new rules of the Obama administration, we could be confident that this woman would be informed that she need not participate in privately funded religious activities that happen separate from the grant program in order to receive the federally funded social services. Or consider a different case. Assume a woman participates in a pregnancy prevention program that's funded by a federal grant, but is bothered by the fact that the program leader proselytizes. Under the Obama rules, we could be sure that the woman would learn that providers receiving direct federal aid must separate any privately funded religious content from the government-funded program, and she would also have specific information about how to report any violations of the rules to the relevant government entity. Now, I've been referring to these as the Obama rules, but it's very important to remember that President Obama adopted these rules based on the recommendation of a very diverse advisory council made up of people of different political leanings, different religious traditions and no religious tradition, and different ideological perspectives. So it really was a common ground project, and these added protections for beneficiaries were the result of common ground deliberations. So, you know, with the incorporation of these new common ground protections and federal regulations, we saw that, you know, they helped to tamp down some of the controversy over partnerships between the government and faith-based organizations. Now, to be sure, some progressives still oppose certain rules that President George W. Bush had put in place, but these new protections ameliorated their concerns while also drawing the support of conservatives. And again, in addition to the substantive protections, the written notice served the key purpose of ensuring that beneficiaries actually knew about the protections that were there for their religious liberty. And at the same time, it served as a good reminder for religious providers about the rules that are in place. When they handed out these notices, they were reminded that these are the things that they have to carefully observe. Earlier this month, however, President Trump signed an executive order that strikes the alternative provider requirements from President Obama's executive order. President Trump's order also strikes the requirement that beneficiaries receive a written notice outlining protections for their religious liberty. So these beneficiary protections were removed, and thus the confidence we had about cases like the ones I described earlier was also removed. The White House offered no explanation, at least that I saw, for its actions, but supporters of the initiative described a few justifications. First, they said that requiring religious providers to make reasonable efforts to identify alternative providers and offer referrals was not a good use of these religious providers' time, they said. They said if there's any referral requirement, it should be placed on government instead. Now, religious providers under certain laws and regulations have long had to make referrals to alternative providers under a few federally funded programs with no reported problems that we have seen. But deciding to place this responsibility on government instead, that could prove to be a respectable choice. But striking the religious liberty protections, which is what President Trump did, is not, in my view. The second proffered justification for rescinding these protections was that some pro-life religious providers fear, apparently, that they would have to make referrals to providers that also offer abortions. Now, available data that we have suggests that these referrals are rarely requested, and this specific kind of referral request seems even more unlikely. In such a case, however, the religious provider, if it did have this kind of objection, could request and receive an accommodation under the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, one that would honor their objection and also find another way to make a referral, in other words, have someone else do it who didn't object to making the referral. What the federal government should not do, in my view, however, is remove protections for religious liberty of countless Americans, in this case, social service beneficiaries, due to the slight possibility that a religious organization might one day have to successfully raise a RFRA objection to a referral. Some have also said that the separation requirements, ones requiring that privately funded religious activities be separated from government grant funded activities, should be the real focus. In other words, the separation requirements should be the thing we work on, and the alternative provider requirements are not really needed. Now, to be sure, the separation requirements are very important, but one cannot assume that those requirements will always be perfectly observed. And even if they are, some may still object to receiving federally funded services in a religious context. And if we are to respect the consciences of beneficiaries, and I certainly believe we should, then we should include these additional protections too. And that's exactly what the diverse advisory council that was established by President Obama recommended. It's also been said that referrals are rarely requested, so eliminating the protection won't make a difference for beneficiaries. It does seem that requests for referrals are rare, but that doesn't mean they aren't important. And I just refer back to my example about the Orthodox Jewish man in the church. You know, just because protections aren't widely used don't mean that they're not extremely important to the people who claim them. Further, the fact that referrals are apparently rarely requested means that the entities charged with making the referrals should not have much work to do to comply with those requirements. So just in closing, I would, you know, offer my views summarized here to just say that the religious liberty of beneficiaries is no less important than the religious liberty of providers or anyone else. We have to protect everyone, providers, beneficiaries, everyone involved in these transactions and partnerships. And also, I think removing the religious liberty protections for beneficiaries in the name of religious liberty actually taints the very great cause of promoting religious liberty. So by doing this, I feel that President Trump not only dealt religious freedom a serious blow, he also damaged efforts to find common ground on church-state issues and undermined support for partnerships the government forms with faith-based entities. And my view is that one way or another, those who value religious liberty for everyone and these very, you know, important social service partnerships that serve people in need. In other words, people who count on religious liberty for everyone and these social service partnerships must find a way to fix these mistakes that have been made with this most recent executive order. So with that, I'll just say thanks again. I look forward to your comments and questions, and I'll turn it back over to Stanley now.
All right. Thanks, Melissa. That was clarifying and clear and passionate about some concerns I have as well. So I'd just like to make a few additional comments on what President Trump has done. I've organized them into, let's see, 7 observations, some of them very brief. First one is just this. I think it's very significant, however much we're disagree or agree with the specific things that President Trump has done with his executive order. I think it's really important that this is now the 4th federal administration that's worked away at this topic very seriously, investing resources and thinking about how to make these partnerships work as well as possible. That means constitutionally, but also effectively on the ground. So going back to the Clinton years with laws that Congress passed, the president signed. In one case, one of the laws was kind of a joint project of Congress and the White House. And then with Presidents Bush and Obama having very robust faith-based and neighborhood partnerships initiatives, setting up offices and centers. And then President Trump, who initially didn't speak on this topic, but did allow those centers to continue to operate and appointed, in many cases, new leaders for them, and gradually kind of warmed up to this topic and then issued his own executive order to say, let's continue this, albeit with some changes. So I think that's really important. These are different administrations, very different views on many things, including church-state relationships, but a great deal of continuity over 4 administrations now in a very turbulent time. So I think that's very noteworthy. Secondly, as I just mentioned, both Presidents Bush and Obama had what they called a White House Office of Faith-Based and then they changed the name slightly on the second part of it. These were independent offices with their own name, clearly structured, with an advisor, executive director, who had direct access to the president, could talk to cabinet secretaries and so on. That kind of setup has been changed now in President Trump's executive order. So instead of a new White House office with a new name, there's now a White House advisor for faith-based and opportunity initiatives. This person will be as part of the Office of Public Liaison instead of an independent office. So it's a little bit different configuration. One good thing is there's a close connection with the Domestic Policy Council, and that's important because these things that go on in the so-called faith-based and neighborhood partnership arena have to do with policy. It's not that the government has chaplains that officials go to when something bad happens, or just to rah-rah about the importance of faith or secular groups or whatever, but this has to do with policy and how to make it better. And so good to have a connection with the Domestic Policy Council. A little bit troubling that this official is located in the Office of Public Liaison, which is an outreach office, not a policy one. But I will say that in the executive order, the president stressed that this White House official will be working regularly with the agency centers that Melissa talked about and I've talked about in these various federal agencies to make sure that policy listens to local groups, that barriers are not put in the way where they shouldn't be, and that a kind of grassroots and even a faith-friendly atmosphere is created in federal programs consistent with laws and constitutional principles. So even if the new advisor is in the Office of Public Liaison, there still is this very strong link into policymaking, and I think that's really important. Third, President Trump did not enter office, as far as I can see, with a strong a history of working with faith organizations the way President Bush had and President Obama as well. They'd, in their own work in the past, had a lot of connection with community organizations and faith organizations. President Trump has a different experience. But he did stress during the campaign and since he's been president, religious freedom or religious liberty is an important thing that he wants to lift up. And you may recall that Attorney General Sessions was asked to last fall to write up a document on how the federal government could could respect the religious freedom requirements of the Constitution in its operations. So a very lengthy document about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and grants and contracts and other things that the government does. And so in this executive order that President Trump signed, one thing he did was to say that in federal agencies, offices that don't have a faith-based and neighborhood partnership center, I should change that, they're now called faith-based and opportunity initiative centers. If they don't have a center, they ought to have a designated official who will be a liaison to the White House official. And I think one of the ideas here is that if persons or organizations run into some obstruction because they're religious, because of their religious exercise, they have somebody to talk to about why is there this restriction, is it appropriate, should it be cleared away. So I think that religious freedom focus comes out in this establishment of these new liaisons across the federal government. Fourth point, Melissa's spoken very clearly about what's happened with the alternative provider guarantee that was put in place on the advice of that very diverse advisory council under President Obama. I do think that alternative, I call it a kind of super protection. I do think the primary protection is that federal direct funds can't be spent on proselytizing, religious activity, that providers can't discriminate against somebody based on religion. But it still is a case that somebody, as she gave some good examples, might go to a provider that is religious and find the environment uncomfortable, or they might not know what their rights are. So the fact that the executive order just removed that alternative, I also think is very unfortunate. So I did hear myself from faith organizations that found the referral obligation to be potentially very troubling. And yes, they do have recourse to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But of course, if these things can be cleared up on a policy basis, that's better than requiring somebody to refer to another law and then make a special arrangement with the officials for a problem they've run into. So I personally think the best way to resolve this was to go back to the charitable choice model, in which the referral requirement was on government. And why do that? Well, the government knows all the other providers they've funded and can easily make a referral. So I think that would be a good solution, although officials have some administrative reasons why they find that a little bit complicated. But I think it would be a good solution, and it seems to me important, even if these referrals have rarely been requested or maybe hardly ever, that there is that protection there because of the kinds of instances that Melissa proposed, and also because it helps everybody who's thinking about this to realize that there really are very solid protections for people of different religions in our very diverse society. So I would recommend that the Trump administration revisit that and not remove the guaranteed alternative, but find a different way to implement it. Fifth, Melissa did mention that as part of taking away the guaranteed alternative, also the written notice went away. Those were parts of the same provision in an executive order from President Obama that was changed by President Trump. So it's possible that notice could be brought back. It's in the regulations. They haven't been changed yet. Original charitable choice language didn't include written notice, but when the Bush administration wrote the regulations for charitable choice, they wrote in notice. And why do that? Well, exactly as Melissa said, if somebody doesn't know what their rights are, then they're not really very effective rights. And then secondly, by having the beneficiary know what their rights are, that makes sure that the provider is reminded themselves of what those rights are. They have to hand them out. They know that somebody knows what they are and can check up on them and report them and so on. So it's an important check, I think, in systems that can be casually or, and fortunately not very often, but sometimes actually deliberately not looking out for all the rights of vulnerable people. And so the notice requirement, I hope, will come back in a suitable form. Sixth, just a kind of reminder of this whole effort, and Melissa made some comments about this. This is about making sure that federal dollars, federal authority when it comes to non-financial partnerships, all goes to the best possible end, and that's to make sure that people who need assistance get assistance and it's effective for them, their rights are respected. And we know that with some of the things that President Trump has put on the table as important initiatives, then a faith and community focus can be quite important. Just think of the opioid crisis that is so important and needs to be addressed. Part of that has to be the prescription patterns and making sure that those are not abused and finding non-addictive kinds of pain relief and all those kinds of things that are being done by the federal government. But it seems pretty clear that an aspect of the opioid crisis has to do with a loss of a sense of hope by persons and families and communities, maybe a kind of fraying of the social fabric that's happened in various places around the country. And so that's a kind of faith in a community kind of emphasis. And so it's, I think, very significant that under President Trump, the Health and Human Services Partnership Center has been working just as previous administrations did to reach out to communities of faith, institutions of faith, and also local groups of other kinds to see how they can best engage on this opioid crisis in the way that they can do best. And then finally, in seventh and finally, this common ground aspect. So there are some changes. Both Melissa and I find some of that troubling because it does break with some common ground principles that have been carefully developed. You know, every administration faces some choices because they see some things they would like to change. I think even when those are pretty important, it's always worth thinking about the continuity and common ground that's been built up in the past. In this case, over four administrations, some principles that a wide range of different groups, different perspectives have come to accept as being a fair way to engage faith organizations in federal programs and protect both the organizations and beneficiaries. And I think that's an important resource, that common ground that was built and ought not to be taken away unless absolutely necessary, because it's just terrible in a polarized time for this to become another an issue that gets batted back and forth as administrations change hands. So I would ask myself to join Melissa in saying to the Trump administration, I think there's probably a better way to deal with this issue with the referrals, one that would assure people that beneficiary rights are being fully protected while also making sure that faith organizations that take part aren't burdened in a way that's unfair to them. So with that, that's our introduction to the Trump executive order on the faith-based initiative principles and the apparatus and how it comes on the background. And then we will welcome questions that people have.
Let's go to audience question and answer. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first audience question.
Hi, I have a question that was a difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration, which is the treatment of religious groups based upon their deeply held religious beliefs on issues like same-sex marriage and sexual orientation. And I wonder if that was dealt with in any specific way or how you see that playing out under these this executive order.
Well, so this is Stanley, and Melissa may want to jump in. So that's an issue that really came to the fore mainly after the Bush administration, and the Obama administration did take some action on that. This executive order from President Trump doesn't say anything specifically about that one way or the other. I think one thing I would say is that here's, as you know, all those listening in, and know this is a very difficult issue of how to be fair, respectful, give equal treatment to people not regarding sexual orientation, gender identity, but also deal with the and also different views of marriage, and deal fairly with the quite diverse views there are in the public about this. So how can that best be done? The Obama administration actually addressed that a little bit in some of the grant programs, but I'll leave it to Melissa if she wants to jump in.
So thanks. Yeah, I agree with Stanley's description of this as an important and sensitive issue. The main action that the Obama administration took in this space would be the federal contracting executive order. Now, I'll describe all that, but let me first say that I don't have statistics on this, but the overwhelming share of partnerships that are financial between the federal government and faith-based and community groups are based in grants or indirect aid like vouchers or certificates. Very rarely are they structured through contracts, although there are some, but very few. So, you know, the contracting order only applied to organizations that served as federal contractors, and mostly these kind of partnerships we're discussing are subsidized through grants and other forms of federal aid. But the federal executive order on contracting, a longstanding order, when President Obama came into office, it prohibited discrimination on the basis of a variety of grounds, race, gender, national origin, for example. And President Bush added a religious exemption to that order. So the order also prohibited discrimination by federal contractors on the basis of religion. President Bush exempted religious organizations from the prohibition on religious discrimination in the executive order, which had the effect of allowing religious organizations who served as federal contractors to continue to prefer and to exclusively hire people of their own faith, even though they were federal contractors. But the Bush order specifically said that the rest of the order's prohibitions, like prohibiting discrimination on the basis of race and national origin, gender, still applied to religious organizations that were federal contractors. And as any of you know who've looked at this, that can be a little bit complicated sometimes to look at how you parse when a religious organization asserts a religious reason for making a choice. Is it protected by the exemption, or is it prohibited by the rest of the order, which continues to apply? We probably don't have time to get into all of that, but I'll just mention it. When President Obama came into office in the second term, he added the prohibition on discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity to the list of issues upon which federal contractors may not discriminate, or bases, I should say. At the same time, he left the exemption, the religious exemption that President Bush had put in place. He just left it intact. He did not rescind it. He did not expand it. He left it as it was. So that's the main thing I would point to as one of the issues that's relevant in this space.
We have another question in the queue, so let's go to that next caller.
I had a question for Dr. Stanley. You stated that you would support bringing back the written notice requirement in suitable form. Could you elaborate on any particular changes that you meant by that should be different if it were brought back?
So by saying in suitable form, I wasn't actually thinking about any particular changes, but if there's not a referral requirement, if that's not resurrected, if that, you know, that particular part of the executive order that was amended is not just brought back, President Trump said he didn't want that, then there will have to be some presumably there'll be some kind of statement of what ought to be the written requirement. And so I think the items that were in there previously were perfectly fine. It could be that I think the notice requirement was for religious organizations that got funding and not for secular ones, and that's partly because, or mainly because, the main emphases in there were the religious requirements, that the religious activities and prohibitions that apply to faith organizations, and that's what the rights, written rights, were about. But it so happens that we have some federally funded research which shows that sometimes secular organizations also may offer religious activities and some religious talk in the services they provide, and it could be that somebody would object to those as well. So I think the notice requirement about basic rights that recipients have, beneficiaries, probably could be expanded to everyone, whatever the organization is that's providing the services.
And this is Melissa. I just add, I don't have any objection to the notice going as wide, you know, notice being given to both faith-based and non-faith-based providers. I know that, you know, there's one level of principle and then there's another level of practicality. And I remember when we were working on this with the agencies, there were some practical issues that they felt like were insurmountable in making sure that the notice went more broadly. But that's not, you know, that's not my area of expertise. But if that broadening out of the requirement is done, which again, I have no dispute with in principle, I think we just need to talk about what, if any, are the remaining practical concerns
and that's
in that regard.
Yeah, that's a good reminder. So when I worked in the President Bush's faith-based office too, I learned a huge amount about how programs are administered, but that's a lot different than administering them. And of course, through the regulatory process or program design or so on, that's really important as to what actually is doable, what's feasible, what fits with the actual way services are provided and audits are done and all those kinds of things. So I would second Melissa's point there, that this is something that people who are designing programs, running programs, that need to be involved in what's practical and not practical. I think one of the challenges here that has had to be discussed at every step of the way is making sure that appropriate protections are put into place when religious organizations are involved, because, you know, they're religious, so that means they have a different character. And so their tendency to want to offer religious activities as part of their programming is stronger than the typical secular organization, although sometimes in secular organizations too there is religious talk and so on. And since there is more of that religious talk, religious activity that's associated with religious providers, then there have to be specific protections and notice and so on that goes with that. But that needs to be done in a way that doesn't kind of subtly change the balance for a government official who's saying, you know, who's going to get the grant, and is it going to be harder to administer one rather than the other? It's worth just saying that this is one of the issues that's been struggled with, that's actually not a church-state issue, that has come up all the time, that federal government in some ways would like to engage smaller organizations, religious or not, just because they're smaller, they're closer to the ground, they are more adapted to the particularities of this neighborhood and that one. But, of course, it's harder to administer programs that have a lot of small organizations involved than administer a federal program that engages, gives grants to, say, two big organizations instead of 15 small ones. But the smaller ones may actually be more effective in some ways, although they're harder to manage. So how to write rules that spend the money wisely, that take all these differences into account, I think is just a continual challenge. And that's also always, for me, a kind of a good reminder. When I see something, hear something that's coming out from an administration, I kind of think, that seems really odd to me. It could be that actually somebody looked into it more deeply than I ever knew I should look, and that's why some changes were made.
Well, it looks like we're almost up on our time. Are there any closing remarks either of you would like to make?
I'd just like to thank everybody for the conversation. I think it's really important. I'd like to thank Stanley for his very helpful remarks. I concur with him about the sense of continuity and wanting to make sure that we, keep our eye on the ball in terms of serving people in need in the best way possible and protecting religious liberty for everyone.
Yeah, so I second that and thank the Federalist Society, also Kim Colby and the Religious Liberties Practice Group for having this call. And it's really important for us as part of the public and also those who are involved as advocates and officials to think these things through carefully, to be constitutional, but then to build something that can be lasting, that people can regard as fair and as part of the common good that we owe to each other.
Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for Friday, June 1st at 1 p.m., and that call will be on the supply chain, the role of Chinese equipment in U.S. tech. Remember to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming telephone calls and to consult the full schedule of our calls on FedSoc's website. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.